Maine, and he went there with three big to-dos on his list. Do you all remember the three things that he really wanted to do while he was there? See a moose? Lobster. And there's one more. I don't know if he said this one in this service. He said it in the second one. He wanted to eat some pie. And so I have been keeping up with Pastor Wayne while he's been on his trip. I think I have a picture of him here on a boat. They were getting ready to go out for a nice ride. But I'm happy and excited to report to you that he has indeed eaten the lobster. He has enjoyed the pie. And he has indeed seen a moose. A dead one that is stuffed, but we're going to give it a pass, okay? We're going to say that he checked off all of the list. He's been missing you guys, and he can't wait to be back with you next week. But I'm so honored that I get to be his substitute today and get to be here with you this Sunday. Many of you guys know that I am from a very small place, a place called Powderly, Kentucky. I'll go ahead and tell you it's in Muhlenberg County because the county helps in order for you to know even where to begin to look. But it's so small, our population is 846. I'm really glad they got that extra person like kind of thrown in there. It helps us look a little better. But, you know, think about that. If you open up your bulletin this morning and you look at the attendance for Broadway last week, you'll see that the attendance of this church exceeds the size of my hometown. So this place where I live, it's again, not huge, but it's been a long time since I've lived there. And so sometimes I'll run into someone from Powderly, and there's this one thing that I always say to them that helps them immediately know a little bit about who I am. I'll meet them, and I will say to them, I was a Sparks. And just by saying that, they instantly kind of have some sense of what's important to me because of my connection to my larger family. They'll be like, oh. And they'll immediately know that education must be important to me because my mom, my dad, my sister, most of my uncles and cousins, they all teach school. And then they would also kind of immediately know that basketball is probably important to me because my dad and most of his brothers, they are all coaches and all of us kids play. And then kind of connected to that, they would probably immediately know that winning is probably important to me because the Sparkses are just a tad bit competitive, just a little. Right, Jeremy? Not much? Yeah, a bit. Yeah. But the names that we carry, they often do this, right? They kind of encapsulate for other people who we are and what we're about by pointing them to this bigger thing that we are connected to. And so this morning, I would like for us to think about the name that all of us share as a part of this community of faith. The name that we, you know, not this building, right, but the people, we are the Broadway United Methodist Church. Maybe I can remember our name in just a second. Let me try again. We are Broadway United Methodist Church. And so when others hear that name, when we say that we are this church, what is it that they assume? And kind of associate with us. Well, first of all, they probably instantly assume that we are a church that is located on Broadway, which is a little tricky, isn't it? Because in all actuality, neither of our churches are still located there. But what that name does do is points people back to where everything began for us as a community of faith. It points them back all the way to 1908, when State Street United Methodist, which is downtown Bowling Green, right, whenever it had this dream, this vision of planting an outpost of hope on what was then the outskirts of town, okay? Let's talk about what the outskirts of town was. It was the intersection of Broadway and 31W, okay? If you know where KFC, Walgreens, and Taco Bell are, we were on the other corner right there. So that's where we got our start, and obviously we're not still there, we've kind of spread out, but it does give people a sense of who we are. But what about the rest of our name? What does it mean when we say that we are a United Methodist Church? What does it say about who we are and what is important to us? You know, I'm going to assume that there's probably quite a few of us here in this room who haven't always claimed that name. I haven't in my life. I grew up as a Southern Baptist. And in this room, I know that there are some people who grew up as a Presbyterian or a Catholic or a Church of Christ. Then you might have even claimed to be an agnostic or an atheist. So if you're like me and you're not a lifelong Methodist, you might be wondering, what does this name mean? What are we really about? But let's be honest here. Maybe some of us have been Methodists our entire lives, from the moment we were born, and even we are still not really sure. And so over the next few weeks, we as a church, we want to explore this together. We want to talk about what it means to be a Methodist as we look back at our history to discover what is important to us. Today, the big goal is to give you a big picture, okay, so that in the weeks ahead, you'll be able to zoom in on different parts of our story and learn more about who we are. But as we get started today, I want to kind of preface this by telling you some of the reasons we are not doing this, because I think that's helpful for us. We're not going to lean in to this series about being Methodist because we're stuck on something, okay? We're not doing this because we're stuck on the past, kind of wishing away the present by pining for the past. No. Rather, we are looking back at our 300-year history because we think that there is something important that we can learn about who we are today that can also help guide us into the future. Furthermore, we're not going to do this because we're stuck on denominations. Let me tell you a very important but often little-known fact about us, okay? The Methodist Church, it didn't start as a denomination, and it was never, ever intended to be one. It was actually intended to be a movement within the existing church. It was never supposed to splinter or separate, but rather it was supposed to renew and to revive the Anglican church. So what happened, right? Because obviously we did at some point separate. Well, we happened, okay? The United States of America came about. There was this little thing called the American Revolution. And whenever we won our independence, it kind of meant that the Church of England that has the King of England as its head, it didn't really exist here anymore. And so something had to happen so that the movement can continue on. And it's only in that kind of strange situation and out of necessity that Methodism, which had spread across the colonies and the frontier, ever became its own thing. Finally, we are doing this series not because we are stuck on thinking that we are special or superior. No. We would say to you that we at our heart believe what all other Christian denominations do at their heart. At the core of who we are is not us trying to point out what makes us different or point out what makes us distinct, but rather at the core of who we are is that our main focus is on Jesus. That's why we're calling this series The Jesus Way, because seeking after him was how this movement that we are still a part of came to be. And it's still the thing that we hope that when we say, I am a Methodist, that people will associate with us right off the bat. We want to be known as a people who are for Jesus, not about what we're against. We want to be known as a people who lift Jesus high, not try to elevate ourselves. This is precisely the thing that the founder of the Methodist movement was seeking to do. To unite people as being for Jesus in the midst of a time where all these followers of him were arguing, sometimes to the death amongst themselves. His hope was to lift high Jesus in a time when many people had been repelled or felt rejected by the church. You see, this was in the midst of a time that was very turbulent. It had been about 200 years since the Reformation. And since then, depending on who was in power and what their political motivations might be at that moment, sometimes England was Catholic. Sometimes it was aligned with the Anglican Church. At one point, it was even under the control of a group that would come to be known as Puritans. But regardless of who was on top in that moment, all of this infighting was always going on amongst followers of Christ. Now, These people who were doing most of the fighting, they were the rich and the powerful amongst the people, right? They were the people who had the time and the money and the status to even have a voice to be heard. And so guess who was getting left out in the midst of all of this chaos? Ordinary people were, and Jesus himself, right? Ordinary people, they became more and more distant from the church. They started to back away because they weren't trusting what they were seeing, what was going on. And quite frankly, they just started losing interest in it. And who can blame them, right? And so the poor and the imprisoned, the working class and children, they weren't able to see the power and the presence of Jesus being reflected in the life of the church. And so as a result, they began to lose sight of the hope that Jesus could bring. It's a situation that, if we get really honest, it doesn't sound all that different from the climate that we have today, a time in which there's religious and political division, a time in which people seem to not be so concerned about what they're for, but what they're against, a time in which people are seeking to elevate themselves. And as a result, it's a time in which there is a disconnect between the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ and the people who most need to discover its hope. There are people that are walking away from the church more and more, especially young people today. But it was in the midst of this similar, very disconnected, divided environment that our Methodist movement was born. This is the founder of the Methodist movement. This is John Wesley. And as we'll see over the next few weeks, he was a great but imperfect man. He never wanted to be put up on a pedestal, okay? And people focus on him, as we'll see as we talk about this movement. But he lived from 1703 to 1791 in England, but he did spend a short period of time here in America as a missionary. Does anyone who hasn't been there this past week, Callie, know where he was? Anybody know? All right, Callie, you can tell them. Savannah. Yes, he was in the Savannah area in the colony of Georgia, and we'll talk more about that in the weeks ahead. But he grew up in a very strict Anglican home. This is his parents, Samuel and Susanna. Samuel was an Anglican priest. And then his wife, Susanna, she wasn't allowed to be a priest, but she still, we could say she did teach and, dare we say, preach out of her own home. She was quite the force. If you're going to read about anybody in the Methodist movement, she's a fun one to look at. She was perhaps the greatest spiritual influence on the life of John and all of her children. There were 19 children in all, okay? That's quite a large family, even in that day and time. And John was the 15th one. And as he got older and he grew up, he decided he was going to follow in his father's footsteps. He was going to take on the family trade, and he was going to become an Anglican priest. And so he went to Oxford to study. And it's there that he received an excellent education, a very classical education, and where he was trained to very intellectually talk about his faith, to dig into theology. He had that foundation that was laid there. And it was actually there that he was first called a Methodist. He was a part of this small group of men who had all of these different names that were kind of attached to them. They got all these nicknames. I think they called themselves more or less the Holy Club. Some people called them the Bible Moths. And then there was this name called Methodist that came up. And let me explain how we got there. It wasn't necessarily a term of endearment. There were these men, and all that they wanted, their deepest desire, was to be what they called a real Christian. And so they would get together every week to pray together and study the scriptures. They would get together to take communion and to fast. They would get together to visit prisoners and the sick. They'd get together to go and to visit the poor. And so, you know, that's kind of a lot. They tried to do all of that every single week. And so they had this system to get all of this done together, right? It was pretty methodical. And it was something that people on the outside from this group could see very clearly. And so they started to call them Methodist. John Wesley did not like this name. He wasn't at all excited about it. But again, because it was so clearly observed, it was something that just kind of stuck. And so finally, he just embraced it. However, despite all of this, despite John Wesley's rigorous religious upbringing, despite his exceptional education, despite being a part of this group of people who very intently did works of piety and works of mercy every single week, despite becoming a minister and a missionary himself, John Wesley, he struggled greatly as a young adult. Greatly. As we'll see in the weeks ahead, he would have some pretty significant failures. And he would wrestle with some very serious doubts. Doubts about his faith and his purpose. When it came down to it, it seemed like all that he knew in his head was somehow disconnected from his heart. Sure, he knew a whole lot about Jesus, and he was trying to do everything he possibly could to be a good Christian on the outside. But inwardly, he just wasn't feeling it. This was stressful for him because, remember, he wanted to be a real Christian, not a nominal one, someone who followed Jesus in name only. He wanted to be all in his faith. He wanted Jesus to be his all in all. But there seemed to be this great chasm between where he was and where he wanted to go. This all changed, however, one night when John Wesley was nearly 35 years old. It was on May 24, 1738. He found himself at this kind of like Bible study that he really didn't want to go to. He'd gone quite reluctantly. Whenever he got there, they were reading kind of like a commentary. It was the preface that Martin Luther had written to the Epistle to the Romans, okay? You guys, for my job, I have to read commentaries like this like quite a bit. And I can tell you they're helpful. They're kind of fun for nerds like me. But I would never say that they're like exciting, like life-changing, right? But some way, somehow, John Wesley very personally encountered the Jesus that he had only known in theory through what was read that night. This is what he wrote in his journal about what happened. About a quarter before nine, while he was describing the change which God works in the heart through faith in Christ, I felt my heart strangely warmed. I felt I did trust in Christ, Christ alone for salvation. An assurance was given me that he had taken away my sins, even mine, and saved me from the law of sin and death. Suddenly, in that moment, all that John Wesley had known in the abstract about Jesus Christ became real to him. Suddenly, on that night, Jesus moved from this concept that he knew in his head to a person whose love he had experienced. And it turned his world upside down. As he sensed Jesus calling him to this holiness of both heart and life. But soon enough, this inward transformation, it could not be contained. It could not help but to be turned outward so that John Wesley, he started turning the world around him upside down as well, as he became willing to do whatever it took to help others experience and know the love of Jesus that he had found. He started going to the masses of people who had become disillusioned with the church. He started preaching the good news of Jesus Christ to the very people who had become disconnected from it. And he did it in a pretty unorthodox way, okay? He did it in a way that wasn't really happening much around then, a way that the church frowned upon. This is what he did. He went out into the fields, and people who would never darken the door of a church would gather around him and be able to hear the good news of Jesus Christ. Preaching was supposed to take place inside the four walls of the parish's church. But John Wesley, he just declared, "The world is my parish." And he did not give up one bit his preaching to the masses, no matter what his critics said. Instead, do you know what he did? He just enlisted more help. But in that day and time, it had kind of come to the point where clergy people, the people who were trained and who had been ordained, they were the ones who did the work of ministry. But John Wesley, he started looking around and he saw all these lay people who Jesus was at work in their life and who had all of these gifts that they could offer to the world. And he started imagining the impact that these people could have if they were turned loose for Jesus Christ. And so, without an education, without ordination, John Wesley started equipping them and sending them out to preach. He even sent out women. We have a picture of some of the women preachers and leaders in this movement, something that was pretty scandalous at that time, something that I'm personally grateful for today. But he enlisted their help as well. Clearly, John Wesley, he wasn't afraid to break the rules. And you know what? He wasn't afraid to try new things either. He started organizing people into classes so that they could come together and learn from one another about Jesus and at the same time love one another as they were following him. He started a place called the Foundry. Does that name sound familiar if you've been around for a while, right? We have a foundry across town, right? But the original foundry, it was this old cannon factory. And the movement, they bought it and they started to take what had been this place that had built weapons of destruction to be this place of grace, where they encountered the poor in extraordinary ways, doing what we might call today like microloans, you know, so that people could get a start in life. Doing things like offering medical care, leasing houses, offering a school to children who were wandering the streets. For Wesley, both proclaiming the good news of Jesus Christ and actually being the good news of Jesus Christ in tangible ways were of utmost and primary importance to him. This practical theology, as it came to be called, it became one of the things that became clear to the world watching this movement. One of the things that was important to us as Methodists, to all Christians as a part of this movement, we were trying to emphasize that it's not just what we think about God that's important. That is, but just as important is how that impacts how we live our lives. So that the very same people who are praying and reading scripture are the ones that are feeding and caring for the poor. So that those who are gathering in small groups and listening to sermons are the very same ones who are going out and bringing about social change. So that those who are gathering to encourage and watch over one another in love are the very same ones who are going out to build orphanages and hospitals and community centers and schools. The Methodist movement, they tried to emphasize again, it wasn't an either or kind of thing, but for followers of Christ, it's always both and. And so what does it mean to be Methodist? Essentially, it means to be a passionate follower of Jesus Christ, to know him and to make him known. That's why John Wesley loved the book of 1 John so much. And it's a book that we're going to turn to again and again throughout this series. This is what he said about it. How plain, how full, and how deep a compendium, I knew I wouldn't be able to say it when I got up here, of genuine Christianity. Now let me pause here to say, like if you're going to go home and start to read John Wesley, he lived in a different time, and he wrote in a different style, and he liked to use words that we don't use as much today anymore. Compendium, for example, right? When's the last time you just like randomly use that in a sentence? Try it today. Your friends will be very impressed, all right? So just in case you don't know, a compendium is a collection of concise but detailed information about a specific subject, okay? And that is a perfect description of what 1 John is. It is indeed concise. It's only 5 chapters long. You could go home and read it in 15 to 20 minutes today. But squeezed into that small, small space is a whole lot of information about a specific subject. And that subject is Jesus Christ. It would be very difficult to find a book that is more focused on him, as it teaches us how Jesus enables us to know God and to live the full, abundant life that God so wants for us. The book stresses to us in its very opening chapter that it's not trying to tell us anything fancy or new, but rather it is trying to reinforce to us, to call us back to in a time that was kind of tumultuous, like in Wesley's time and today, to call us back to that which we have heard from the beginning, that Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. And that we are to live like him. And so that means we are called to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. To call us back to what we have heard from the beginning, that through Jesus, we see that God is love. And so we are called to love because he has first loved us. Can you imagine the impact on our world? If that was something that we deeply believed, not just in our heads, but that we pursued with all of our hearts, driven and propelled by Christ's love for us. That's exactly how the Methodist movement got its start. And again, John Wesley's goal wasn't to start some new denomination, but to be a part of a movement that would renew the church, that would call ordinary people back to living out their faith in Jesus in very real and practical ways. His hope was to start a Jesus movement. And it is with that same hope that we come to this table today. As we encounter Jesus himself through this simple yet significant meal, my prayer is that his love would turn our worlds upside down so that we could not help but go out from this place to love others the way that he has loved us and to lay down our lives. Would you pray with me as we prepare to come? Lord God, as